call to order the House Committee on Human Services.
How about the Ways and Means Subcommittee?
Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, House Committee, Joint Ways and Means.
There we go.
You are a rookie, aren't you?
Where am I?
Need some training. For you.
I haven't even had my first cup of coffee yet this morning. We're continuing on with the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division of Department of Human Resources, or Human Services. I'd like to go ahead and proceed.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Barry Cass. I'm the Administrator of the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. We hope today, in view of the schedule that has been set forward for next week, to finish our hearings on the mental health portion of the budget so that we can take up on Monday the developmental disability program. Where we left off yesterday was with a discussion of what's happening at Oregon State Hospital and our state hospital services with respect to capacity. We do have two packages, and I'd like to ask Dr. Mazurhart to come back to just give you some information about that before we move on to some of the things that are required by budget note and statute from the last session. We also have reports on the pharmaceutical pilot project, atypical antipsychotic medications, the budget note on intensive treatment services for children, and the chair has requested an update on what's happening in Multnomah County. So I think we can get through those five issues today, and maybe we can begin there if it's acceptable to you.
You okay with that? Everybody appears to be okay with that? Dr. Mazurhart, welcome.
Thank you.
Your wife was one of my law school professors.
Well,
don't take that personally.
I won't take it out on you personally, but I just thought I'd mention that.
I appreciate that. For the record, my name is Stan Mazurhart, and I'm the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there are two policy packages that affect Oregon State Hospital, one of which affects Oregon State Hospital and Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center. Package number 221.
Can you tell us where you're at in your book?
Yeah.
It's on page 4A50.
Okay. Give us a little time to catch
yes,
up.
Yes, indeed.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The purpose of this package is to meet requirements that have been established by the Healthcare Financing Administration and the Joint Commission on the Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations. Beginning in late summer of 1999, a push came about in which rules were written to greatly reduce and, in fact, wherever possible, eliminate the use of seclusion and restraint in psychiatric facilities in the United States. Accordingly, rules were written to aim toward that goal and to provide better care and treatment for individuals who were in seclusion and or restraint, such as the requiring of one-to-one monitoring of the patient by a staff member throughout that period of time. Patients, as you are well aware, who are in psychiatric emergencies are most at risk for self-harm and injury and are the highest priority for care and treatment to regain personal control. There are 28 positions in this package, 18 of which would be allocated to the Oregon State Hospital and 10 to Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center. At Oregon State Hospital, those FTE would be used to add an additional staff person on swing shifts 7 days a week on 10 wards at the hospital where we have the highest use of seclusion and or restraint. At Eastern Oregon State Hospital, 8 of the 10 positions to be allocated there, if approved, would be used for the same purposes, that is, the duties of staff wherein they provide crisis intervention and management, supportive communication, assistance with problem solving, observation and monitoring of precursors to aggression or self-harm, assistance with activities of daily living, and observation of response to medication and other therapeutic interventions. At Eastern Oregon State Hospital, at Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center, 2 of those 10 FTE would be registered nurses who are needed to provide crisis assessment, to design active nursing treatment and supervise direct care staff during psychiatric emergencies. In effect, this package, again, is aimed at new regulations around seclusion and restraint and are supportive of the hospital and psychiatric center's goals of reducing seclusion and restraint as an emergency intervention, with the hope that eventually and soon, though, it will be eliminated completely in favor of other therapeutic interventions. The other policy package...
Representative Schrader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question on how have other states responded to this HCFA rules? Have they responded with similar approaches, do you know?
Yes, they Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, yes, they have. This is a common approach to dealing with these new regulations. One part of this, in terms of the services and supplies, would be to add video and audio monitoring as well of seclusion and restraint rooms, which is another way to choose to address this. However, the regulations specify that if those kinds of devices are used to watch the room, in effect, and the person in the room, that a trained staff member has to continually monitor the monitors, the electronic monitors, as well.
Officer, Dr. Bates asked yesterday if there were other ways to go about implementing the rule changes that did not require the additional hiring of new people and perhaps this enhanced training. Are you aware of any other ways to accomplish the rule changes from HCFA?
I'm not at this time, Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, I'm not at this time. We have changed our training approaches to managing behavioral emergencies at the hospital with a greater emphasis on precursors to behavior that gets out of control and working with patients ahead of time, working with patients and their families in terms of what are the best treatment interventions for those folks. But when it comes down to it, if the emergency interventions we use now are eliminated, it really leaves staff as the way to deal with those situations.
Last comment, yes, sir. Just would you be open to other ways if they became available?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, certainly, absolutely.
Thank you.
I would move then to package number 222, which are infection control resources that are on page 4A-51 in the binder that you have. And this has a kind of three-part emphasis, the first of which is to enhance staffing in our infection control department from one registered nurse to two registered nurses and an office specialist, too. The responsibilities of the infection control department at the state hospital include tuberculosis screenings, required infection control and bloodborne pathogen education for 1,200 staff, reporting of communicable diseases to the health division, monitoring environmental cleanliness in our aging facilities, maintaining an exposure control plan, instituting emergency control measures for special investigations when there's reason to suspect that a nosocomial infection exists for patients or staff, and employee occupational health. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, recommend a minimum ratio of one infection control nurse for every 250 inpatients in modern hospital facilities. We have a ratio of one infection control nurse for 672 budgeted beds or inpatients, and we have 695 actually today. The most prevalent of those infectious diseases is hepatitis C, which was discussed earlier and which Representative Bates provided a very complete and thorough explanation of, both as to the disease and to the treatment.
The lecture was free. And worth.
I wonder if we can get CLE credit.
Yeah.
Schrader and I want to know that.
Yeah. Probably worth what it cost.
Yeah, it was worth it.
And so the other money in that package would be available to provide treatment to folks who have hepatitis C in the hospital. We currently have about 110, here it's 107, I think we now have 110 folks with hepatitis C, and of that we estimate approximately 35 would be eligible for and amenable to treatment.
Representative Schrader.
Do we have a worse problem than other states in terms of our infection control outcomes? because we're at 1 to 672. We're doing a worse job, have more problems.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, I'm not aware of data that would demonstrate that, though we have recently agreed. We're a member, the state hospital is a member of the Western State Public Psychiatric Hospitals Association. There are 17 states represented and a number of state hospitals, and we've belonged to that for a few years now and have done a number of benchmarking and performance measurement studies whereby we compare with others, for example, on medication errors and those. We have just agreed to do similar benchmarking around nosocomial infections with those hospitals. So eventually we'll have data on that on a direct comparison basis between us and others.
Professor Schrader, appreciate that. I'd like to see those studies and that those performance measures, how we compare on other aspects too. That would be very, very helpful, I think, for this committee as we go into work session. So then you would say then at this point in time that even though we're not at the 1 to 250 standard, our people seem to be doing a pretty good job. I mean, we're fortunate just because at this point in time we haven't had a major outbreak of something, that so far we seem to be managing adequately, but we need to be prepared for the future, is I think what you're suggesting.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, that's correct.
Question. Representative Bates.
Several hospitals in the state of Oregon have found that maintaining a physician or a nurse position for infectious disease, which is very important, is also very expensive. And they've partnered with OHSU to do that. OHSU supplies them with electronics, a method of setting up programs, running those programs without having to get extra FTEs for it. It's been an effective thing. Rogue Valley Hospital is doing that right now. Have you had a chance to talk to OHSU about setting up a PEPPER program and maybe saving some FTEs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I'm not aware if OHSU, but I know that we've had collaborative relationships with Salem Hospital, and in fact, one of the physicians for there has provided in-service training and continuing education around these kinds of issues for our physicians and infection control. Our chief medical officer is here today and could probably better respond in detail to that sort of a question.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up?
I would just ask you to look at that. OHSU is a heavily funded program from the state funds, mm-hmm. as well as private, of course. And anytime we can get a cooperative program going that can save us a duplication of effort and save us money, it's something we should look at. I'll just offer that as a suggestion to you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates will certainly do that.
Thank you.
Good idea. Thank you.
Swing shifts would make a great job for interns.
Yeah,
actually.
Oh, absolutely.
That's the way I had to do it.
Absolutely.
A nice shift.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, let me elaborate just for one moment on the performance measurement issue. Oregon State Hospital is a member of the Western State Psychiatric Hospital Association and also participates in a national database called the ORIC system, which is really the name of the system, comes from the Joint Commission. The National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors has a research institute which is now collecting data from over 200 state hospitals around the country. And in response to Representative Schrader's question, we can provide information to the committee, not only the benchmarking for the Western hospitals, which tend in general, with the exception of Washington State, to be smaller than other hospitals in the country, but also for the roughly 200 state hospitals from almost every state. And Oregon State Hospital is compared and contrasted with the national average and other hospitals in Oregon. There are three in Oregon that are using the same measurement system. So we'll give you a picture of how we compare with other states in terms of some of these measurements.
Great, thank you.
The balance of our testimony today is the completion of the mental health services budget. Madeline Olson will talk about the children's ITS program, which was part of a budget note in our last budget bill. The atypical antipsychotic medications, a report on Multnomah County's progress, as well as documenting the other two budget packages, policy packages that we're bringing forward in this budget.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Madeline Olson, Assistant Administrator for Mental Health Services for the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. And briefly, for the record, Barry mentioned yesterday there are two budget policy packages in the community mental health services budget. Package 219, which you can see in detail starting on page 31 of your book, which is the mental health dollars, $3.5 million general fund for the Oregon Children's Plan to provide mental health services to those firstborn children in the 0 to 8 range. And in the first year, it may be working primarily with relatively young infants and their families, who are identified through the Healthy Start and other screening processes and will then are identified as being at risk. And of those children that are identified as being at risk, through the earlier time with Healthy Start, they anticipate about 20% will need mental health treatment in order to ameliorate those risks and allow the children to enter school ready to learn. The other package is package 220, which is described beginning on page 34 of your book. It's a package to integrate children who are currently treated either at Oregon State Hospital or in the psychiatric residential programs in the community and are ready for discharge, except that they wait longer periods of time in either location because there are no appropriate community placements for them. That package is $4 million, and it would seek to return these children at the point they're clinically ready to a lesser level of a care instead of holding them at higher levels of care. Over the course of the biennium, we would anticipate about 100 children being moved into appropriate levels of care, which then, of course, would make space available in the higher end levels of care for children who really need it. With that, I'll move on to the intensive treatment services.
Representative Schrader.
It's all general fund. Is there no other way to help establish that community services for children without using all general fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, this is a general fund component. As we actually develop the services, we'll be able to capture Medicaid for some of the children whose either circumstances make them eligible by financial means or because of disability. For some of the children, in this part of the mental health system, Medicaid is an institutionally biased program. So when children are in these institutions, they can be eligible for Medicaid. But for some children, when they return to their families and their homes and the community, they lose that Medicaid eligibility, yet the families have little or no insurance, or they've spent it, and in some cases taken out first and second mortgages on their houses in order to provide treatment.
Can we ask for a waiver on that? Have we ever attempted to ask for a waiver on that?
Mr. Chair, there are waiver possibilities in Medicaid law for bringing in disabled children at higher and higher levels of income. We attempted to get a waiver limited just to children who are disabled by virtue of a serious emotional disorder, which is federal language. And because we had defined the class so narrowly, that waiver was denied. If we had defined the class to include all disabled children, there's a chance the waiver would have been approved, but the general fund cost to not only the mental health budget, but the health plan budget and other Medicaid budgets in the state would have been very high. So the state's continuing to work this problem, but at this point, for those kids, unless we're willing to open the gate wider, it's a problem.
Mr. Chair, we have comparable waivers on the developmental disability side for extraordinarily impaired children who have intense medical or behavioral needs. But I know of no state that has a comparable waiver on the this emotional disturbance side.
Okay.
But we could certainly pursue that. I just am not optimistic in this environment that we would get that kind of a waiver, considering that the need to make an eligibility determination that set a clear class and boundary for this for these kids.
This environment being the clear class and boundary for the kids.
This environment being our relationship with the Healthcare Financing Administration around applications for waivers and getting those kinds of things approved.
But even with the new sheriff in town, you're not optimistic.
Mr. Chairman, actually, I am more optimistic. We have the governor has met with Tommy Thompson from Health and Human Services. I think we do have a fairly responsive Department of Health and Human Services, it's going to take some time for that leadership to, I think, really change the relationship between the states and the Healthcare Finance Administration. At the same time, Oregon has had extraordinary cooperation from HICFA around a number of things, including the Oregon Health Plan and some of the things we've been trying to do. So we've been considered a state that has, I think, achieved a great deal by thinking outside the box and so forth. But we could pursue that. I'm just, the budget isn't based on the achievement of a waiver.
I just think we should at least at minimum note that in the budget discussion.
Mr. Chair, I think I responded that we had attempted to get a waiver. That was incorrect. What we had attempted to do was get what's known in Medicaid parlance as a state plan amendment, and that was turned down.
Okay.
If people are ready, I'll move on to the intensive treatment services and the budget note in the pilot.
I think I do have a question. I'm a little confused in this process. Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Go ahead.
You're talking about kids, probably adolescents for the most part, but kids going into a state hospital for a period of time, a couple months, 6 weeks, whatever it takes. And that is commonly covered by Medicaid? Is that what I understood?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, yes.
And when they come out, some of them are because they qualify for OHP or whatever and continue outpatient treatment. And then some come out and they no longer qualify for Medicaid, and those kids may not get outpatient treatment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, that is the circumstances some children and families find themselves in.
Last question, Mr. Chair. Do you have any idea of how many of those kids end up back in a psychiatric hospital again because of a failure to get treatment as an outpatient that their family just can't afford?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I don't have a number off the top of my head. I know from the kind of phone calls that I get from distraught families that it's an issue and a problem.
Thank you.
For lack of a better term, the hospital doesn't track, for lack of a better term, recidivism rates at all as these people, you send them out in the community and they come back?
Mr. Chair, we could do that. It's just not something I have storage in my brain.
Do you track that, though, to look at your effectiveness of your treatment programs and those kinds of things as well?
Readmissions?
Uh-huh.
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Yes,
we do.
You only do what you have to do. I mean, it's a gapping hole here. I mean, it's a gapping hole for most of the state in getting adolescent treatment to start with. And then we're talking about kids we're going to treat as an inpatient. And once they get out, there's a significant number that have limited treatment or no treatment, and they're just out there.
Now, Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, the problem here, as Madeline pointed out, in children's mental health, there is a bias toward institutions because it's out-of-home placement, and dependent children then fall back for eligibility into their families. And where the family income then rises above the threshold, they lose, unless they have a specially qualified disability.
And I understand exactly what you're saying now.
It makes no sense because it encourages children to stay longer in custodial settings. I don't mean custodial in the sense of not treatment, but in the sense that they're in the custody of someone else during that period. And we need to change that, and that's recognized as a problem nationally. But opening the door means opening Medicaid to a lot of people who wouldn't meet the income test, and that problem hasn't been solved. And I don't know how we would solve it. The model waiver is one way to solve it. Say, here's a group of children whose needs are so intense that we're going to make an exception, and the federal government says, okay, we'll make an exception. We've not been successful. States have not been successful on the mental health side in achieving those waivers.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to the intensive treatment services and the budget note. Intensive treatment services include, for purposes of the budget note, the psychiatric residential programs that are community-based. And
Could you reference the page, please?
Yeah.
28. It's actually page 29 and 30 of the book that defines the pilots and some of the programs that are included in them. The intensive treatment services also include the psychiatric day treatment services that are provided in many parts of the state. When we began planning in the mid-90s for moving mental health into the Oregon Health Plan, there was a lot of concern about having these more intensive services, which are tend to be facility-based services, as part of the benefit package. And certainly, given what was happening in the rest of the nation, moving precipitously didn't seem like a good idea. So I think it was the 97 session, the department talked with the providers, and we came up with what I believe was the longest budget note in legislative history, to set out the boundaries with which we, in which the state and the providers would work to find a way to get all of the benefits and the flexibility for the children that are inherent in a prepaid capitated system, as but not destroying the existing array of providers, so that we would have a slow and planful transition. We've continued to work over the course of the ensuing years with the providers. There was a renewal of the budget note in 99, which required us to then come back to the 03 session and report on the progress that we've made and the outcomes of the pilots. But what you find in the book is that we've had a pilot going since May of 1999 here in the Mid-Valley that includes 10 counties and two managed care organizations and a small amount of capacity that is operated by the Trillium Corporation at the Children's Farm Home. And what we're seeing with those early, really early results from those programs is that the kids are able to leave the residential setting early, earlier than they would have before, because when they go into the community, they're transitioned with individualized supports that are negotiated by all of the parties involved in the child's life. The school that they're going to go back to, the family that they're going to go back to, the community mental health program that will provide the outpatient services as the Trillium services transition away from the child, and they're having very good success with that. Children are following their treatment plans, which is one indication that they're staying with the course of treatment. They're entering a mode of maybe on the road to recovery. They're staying in their families longer than matched sets of kids not in the pilot. Now, this is really, really preliminary data because it's very short, but it's very hopeful data at this point. As you can see from the book, we then started with a lot more capacity in the Multnomah County area, and we've also just started in Southern Oregon with the Southern Oregon Adolescent Treatment Program. So we're very, very hopeful that we're going to see some really good outcomes here. And this is really the foundation of our learning that will lets us know what to do that will work for the kids that are the subject of the package I talked about.
Representative Schrader.
I'd be interested in seeing those preliminary results for the Mid-Valley that seem to be the at least the longest running.
Okay, and a few of them are actually referenced in the document.
And could you speak to the relative cost of doing that type of transitioning them into the community care, is what I understand this is basically about, versus, you know, the more intensive care that they've received heretofore? What do we expect them benefits to be, if any, in that regard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, at this point, given the constraints of the budget note, we are constrained to keep the costs paid to the providers constant. So the benefit we're seeing is that as children move through the hard beds more rapidly, more children are getting access to the program, but the dollars are in fact constant, which was one of the main concerns the providers had, that if you have to operate a facility with so many beds, you have core operating costs. And if your revenues are drained away, you then can't operate the facility up to standards. Plus, there's widespread agreement across the state that there's insufficient capacity at this level of care. You could get capacity by adding care and just letting kids be in it for as long as they had to be in it. Or you can get more kids served by more efficiently using the capacity you have. And that's really the route we've taken with the pilots.
Representative Schrader.
Paraphrase, I think, what you just said would be that we're keeping the dollars constant to the providers in the hopes that we can improve access to more children, if you will, versus the limited amount of children we're able to do with just the hard bed philosophy.
Yes.
We're reducing case costs as opposed to trying to save money, so it's a cost avoidance program.
Representative, did you have something to add to that?
I was just going to say that on page 30, you can see we're serving in these preliminary data from the farm home, two children in beds, where in the non-pilot programs are serving 1.6 kids. That's not a lot, but over time that grows and certainly creates more access.
Representative Bates?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not quite sure what I heard there a moment ago when you were describing the program. Is it a program that's run by the county or by an HMO?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, it's a program that, as the in terms of the financing contracting, it runs from the state to the mental health organizations. We don't make those changes until the entire community has come together with a plan. So the cooperation is among the mental health organizations, the providers of the intensive treatment services, and the local community mental health programs, because these children, if we're successful, will return to their homes, and then the local CMHPs will begin to pick up their treatment. For the kids that are covered by the Oregon Health Plan, it will be through their contract with their regional mental health organization.
Maybe I can help here, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
We're not trying to integrate the financing at the state level. We're trying to integrate the financing at the local level by getting all of the parties to work together. So you have a county mental health organization, the children's residential provider, maybe a day treatment program, and by working together through their existing streams of funding, more children are getting served. And that's considered a kind of a transitional state, rather than, say, for example, taking the residential dollars, putting them into the capitated contract, and then relying on the incentives to make the plan work out. That may be down the road, but that's not in the works right now. I hope that made sense. What we have had is a very fragmented financing system, and we are very pleased that the providers and the mental health organizations at the local level are working together. And based on this pilot, as you can see on page 29, we now have pilots either running or in the works in a number of regions of the state, because this makes sense. In the long run for kids, it just makes sense to do business this way. And we'll get to where much of the rest of the healthcare industry is, but it's going to take us more time on the high end.
Paula?
What I'm trying to get to, Mr. Chair, is there's been some concerns about how effective county mental healths are in handling these programs for adult programs, too. And we can't seem to find out what goes on there as far as encounter numbers, FTEs, amount of money going into programs. There have been other programs that have been run by the organizations. There are HMO-type capitation run not by the county to serve some of these populations. What I want to know in this situation here, is this a mixture of this? Is it a hybrid? Is this a county program coming from state funds? I still can't tell from what you just told me what you're really saying. Maybe I'm just dense this morning. I probably am.
Do you want to just give an example from a specific area, maybe, or the structure? Would that be helpful?
Well, I don't want to take up a lot of time. You want to give me the answer later, we'll talk about it. I don't want to we've only got limited time here.
Okay.
We need to move forward.
We have Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, we have a ton of information about this, and we'd be happy to meet with you and share that. But to answer your question, it is not a county program. It is not a provider program. It is not a mental health organization program. It's a pilot that brings those parties together. And I'm intrigued by the concern about the county, whether we have information about counties. We need to do some work to respond to your question from, I've been in kind of jet lag, so I can't remember if it's Monday or Tuesday.
I don't know either.
We're working on your issue about the performance of counties, and we'll be providing you some information about
that
as well.
Go ahead and proceed then.
Okay.
Just make sure you get back with Dr. Bates. And
we will
do that.
Thank you.
Before I move on to talking about the other pilot project for the atypical antipsychotics, there's one issue that I want to just get on the record. There are a set of rules that HCFA published on January 22nd dealing with seclusion and restraint in the psychiatric residential programs throughout the country. These rules were published without the usual open process. They greatly increase the reliance programs will have on nurses and physician time. The rules are on hold but are scheduled unless other action is taken to become effective at the end of May, with providers and states needing to certify by September compliance. A very conservative estimate in Oregon is about $2 million total funds per year if providers could hire all of the staff they would need to hire. None of this is included in the governor's recommended budget, and I just wanted to get that on the record.
Has the state commented on those rules already?
Mr. Chair, the state's commented on the rules. The governor has written to Secretary Thompson. There are provider groups throughout the country working with HCFA to try and... Everyone agrees that it's not good to seclude and restrain without the right protections. People don't agree that this set of rules is the only way to get to that end result.
But we've done as much as we can from...
And we continue to.
And contact.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, last session, Senate Bill 941 was passed, which provided in a reserve... I'm on page 24
around.
Now.
24?
That's to page 24.
All right. I'm worried that the chair's going to get mad at me if we keep pulling backwards any farther in the book. She'll never let me chair again.
After this, we'll leave the book.
All right.
There was $1.9 million reserved for the division to provide atypical antipsychotic medications to people who weren't covered under the Oregon Health Plan. There was a lot of work that was done with advocacy groups, family groups, the pharmaceutical industry, and an agreed-upon plan was presented to several committees, and then the emergency board, and the funds were released from the February emergency board. In 2000, the pilots were chosen on a competitive basis. There are two of them operating in Washington and Multnomah counties. They've been operating a few months, and the other feature of the project was a budget note that required the state to work with Oregon Health Sciences University Department of Psychiatry to do an independent evaluation on a number of measures of the effectiveness, not only of the medications, but the cost effectiveness and the kind of outcomes we would see from this pilot. The full report on the atypicals is in the appendix. I think it's the third item in. It's followed right after by an interim report from Oregon Health Sciences University. At this point, they have not had an opportunity because not enough people are being served and not all of the data has been collected, so they don't have any definitive findings.
Sure.
Representative Schreier.
I guess I have a real problem with that comment. The budget, as I understood, says here, page 53 of our book, to complete an analysis of program expenditures during the 99-01 budget period. And the analysis is expected to identify the cost and benefits. I have a real problem with this program that was funded. I mean, I guess I need to understand. I had a problem with this when it came out. Now, why are we funding a very expensive drug program for people that don't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan? We have huge run-up costs in our Oregon Health Plan already for pharmaceuticals. So I just have a real question about, number one, we don't have results, and number two, we spend a lot of money on something we can't afford.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, we will have results in a wide range of areas. We just don't have them today because of the timing of our hearings relative to the timing of the studies. This bill was...
We'll have them before we work this budget, is that correct?
We'll have more results, yes, before you work the budget.
My other concern, though, is I thought you mentioned to begin with that this one would be inconclusive at all because we're not catching enough people in the net to make it a legitimate kind of study. Is that,
Mr. Chair, will
the position the division is taking right now?
If I said that, Mr. Chair, I didn't mean to imply that. We will be able to serve with the resources available about 300 people. With most of the resources going to medication. The other thing I would say is Senate Bill 941 was not a bill the division sought. This was something that came to us, and we've done everything we could to work within the confines of the negotiations that went on, but it wasn't a bill that we sought out, so we've...
I understand it wasn't a bill that or the division necessarily sought out, but my question is, I mean, we're partway through this thing, and now I want to make sure that we're treating enough people and that we're gathering enough data to come to some conclusion, because I don't want to, we should know now if we should.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me just clarify first that this portion of our budget was not in the governor's recommended budget for the current biennium. It was an initiative that began here.
Our record
is quite clear. We said we would serve 300 people, but it was our belief that most of those people would become eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. So the question of efficacy and so forth remains to be clarified. In terms of the realistic expectation about producing a final report, if the session adjourns in July under the arrangements in the bill, we had to come back, bring forward a proposal, get the funds released, issue a request for proposals. So the horse race has begun, I think, last summer, and what Oregon Health Sciences University has done to I think respond to the requirements of the bill is to provide a mid-project analysis, and the analysis gives some idea of what the results might be, but the final results frankly can't be available during this particular session. But I think most of what we anticipated, and which is a part of the record from the last session, has come to fruition. That is, this is a case-finding project, and most of the people who are being found are subsequently eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, and then those costs transfer into the Oregon Health Plan budget.
The other point that I would note for the subcommittee is that the money to continue this project is not in the governor's recommended budget for 0103. It was established as a pilot project. The $1.9 million was appropriated mid-biennium to start this, but it did come out as a one-timer in the budget, and so there isn't continued funding for the project. Now, theoretically, if it turns out to be a wonderful money saver for this agency or the state as a whole, there's opportunities to go back in rebalances or next session and provide some additional funding. But at this point, it's not a budget package or in the base budget to continue it.
Do we have some kind of placeholder? If the results won't be here by the end of the budget cycle, do we have some placeholder piece so the emergency board can come back if they wanted to continue the pilot?
The usual route, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, would be for the department to do something in a budget rebalance. There's no particular placeholder in the as a special purpose appropriation or anything like that at this point.
We just might want to bring that to the co-chair's attention, because I don't know what... Tom, were you on the emergency board during...
I will be.
Were you? You weren't during the last interim, and Frank was. So I don't know. We just might want to note that for the co-chairs as we're going through the budget detail. They want to put that in, since we won't be able to get the conclusive results, and that way the D board, if they wanted to, could continue the pilot, I assume. Let them make that decision, or we can make that decision.
Mr. Chair, from a clinical perspective in planning this, even in the RFP, we ask each of the respondents to have a plan for transitioning people and being able to continue their medication at the end of the pilot period when the funds were scheduled by the bill that passed to go away. The other thing I would say, Oregon Health Sciences University is surveying all the recently published literature about the effectiveness and cost effectiveness of atypical antipsychotic medications, and they're doing this in order to have the context for the analysis that they'll begin working on of the actual Oregon data. One of the things they've found in these studies that they've been reviewing is that cost savings are generally not seen until 1 to 5 years out, and they are generally not seen in the budgets that pay for the pharmaceuticals or the mental health services. They tend to be seen in other budgets. So that's kind of what a preliminary look is like.
Thanks for the 10,000-foot flyover.
And if you have time, you could read the interim evaluation report, along with all of the other money.
Sounds like good reading.
Bottom line, though, Mr. Chairman, is that, as the report points out, is that the medications add value, and we have a lot to learn about the relationship between the unserved who are not qualified or not yet qualified for other forms of assistance.
The last area I was asked to talk about is what's happening in Multnomah County, and next week we'll provide you with an actual written document. But there's been a lot of concern and a lot of press coverage about the state of mental health in Multnomah County. There's, I think, for a large urban county that had been used to a very strong base of providers with a lot of history behind them, and a set of providers that were among the highest paid under the fee-for-service environment in Medicaid, the change to managed care was a huge change for that community. There was a lot of rethinking of the roles of the county as they became the primary managed care organization in the county. They had at the outset about 70% of the covered lives in the county. And a huge change for the providers who had been used to being able to access Medicaid directly. For group-oriented services with sets of people that would reliably show up every day and be served at a rate that was then reimbursed to the providers. Managed care has changed all of that. There's a lot of risk involved. People are responsible for the cost of hospitalization as well as the cost of outpatient services. You need to begin to think about systems where services are tied together, risk is shared across silos of service. And I think some of the problems in Multnomah County have to do with some of their early financing models kept the risk fragmented and the service silos fragmented. So they ended up with fairly high utilization rates for hospitalization, a risk pool of money to pay for inpatient that is being stressed, outpatient providers who didn't feel reimbursed enough in order to do a lot of crisis work and to reach out and get people discharged early out of the hospital. There weren't the flexible funds that some communities experienced under the change in the managed care that allowed them to open crisis alternative programs to the more expensive acute psychiatric hospital programs. So that created a climate of a lot of change and anxiety expressed by family members and allied agencies of varying kinds. Now, the county leadership, I think, really stepped to the plate in Multnomah County, and they undertook a number of county-wide processes to examine the issues in the county and then to set, through passage of resolutions by the Board of Commissioners, to set a very strong vision and direction and begin to rebuild the mental health system. And they're in, I think, the early stages of that process. The report we'll provide to you will have some data points that compares Multnomah County with statewide data points in terms of numbers of people served, hospital stays used, things like that, penetration rates that compare them to like cities and states. So you'll be able to see, I think they're stabilized, they have hired a change agent and restructured their leadership team. They are within days of having a new business plan that they'll put out. They're beginning to deal with the issues of the funding for their crisis triage center. They're dealing with the issues of the funding for the hospital payment pool and looking at ways they can share risk. The networks that were created, that the providers created, hoping to compete for the Oregon Health Plan have been eliminated, which eliminates an administrative layer so that dollar can be plowed back into services. And they've got just item after item that they're working on. So it looks as if the county has come to grips with their problems and are now on the way towards forming a solution or a set of solutions.
And in addition, Mr. Chair, they have a new management team for the mental health system that includes one position which is of limited duration that is designed to be a change process manager who, in design, will have a short-term rather than long-term investment in the outcome so that perhaps some of the change processes which are difficult to accomplish can be accomplished.
Mayor Shields.
I'm just wondering about the effect and what Madeline just said kind of got my attention. I know that Multnomah County itself's $20 million short on their budget this time, and they've been talking to people like me about their shortages. And we know what the human service budget is like down here. What does all that imply for this new effort, this new approach and everything else? I mean,
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, the future budget for the county is a major issue because in this interim period, the state has invested a little less than $1 million in shoring things up during the interim, but the county has spent a great deal more than that out of its own resources. Multnomah County probably spends the majority of non-state or federal funds in the community mental health system. And so shortfalls in the county budget would probably affect this program significantly. But we don't know yet because the county hasn't completed its budget process. So they're in a sense, they're in a race against time. They need to have a more efficient and effective system and realign their incentives, and some of the shorter-term strategies that they're involved in may accomplish that. But frankly, the consultant's report was really focused on the future, and for example, their recommendation was that the Oregon Health Plan components be integrated with or operated by Care Oregon, which I think would have stepped to the plate sooner, except that with the departure of some fully capitated health plans from the environment, Care Oregon's picking up a lot of work and risk in the short run that really puts mental health on a delayed basis for them. And we'll see if that actually comes to fruition. So there are some short-term things that are happening and some long-term things that might be pretty significant, and we just don't know at this point. We do know what we bought with the money that we spent to keep things from imploding, and Madeline's prepared to talk about that. But I think we're on a month-to-month basis with the county. We're working very closely with them.
I think what we need to do, the House goes into session at 10:30, the Senate goes in at 10:45. I'd like, maybe you can stay with Senator Shields for a few minutes to answer questions that he might have. Are there any other quick questions that you guys wanted to, anything quick that you wanted to cover? I think we've covered kind of the scope of what you wanted to do.
We will provide you with a written document about the Multnomah County situation when we begin next week.
Senator Shields.
And I'd just like to say in the public record that I'd appreciate seeing that document and just add that in the meantime, you know, one of the folks in law enforcement in East County, a city police chief, continues to say that his biggest problem is street-level mental illness, you know, and that just points to some of the problems with the system.
Correct. I just want to announce that Monday, April 9th, we're going to have a public hearing and public testimony regarding Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. Plan for Tuesday is to cover Senate Bill 68 relating to psychiatric treatment services, as well as continue the budget discussion here. On Wednesday is the tour of the Oregon State Hospital. And then Thursday, we have full Ways and Means in the morning. They just announced that this morning at full. They will have full Ways and Means in the morning. We will convene this committee immediately after full Ways and Means ends, and we'll continue. Then Good Friday, the House and the Senate are taking off to have people be able to go return back to their district. So we appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, could I get on the record? I noticed in the paper this morning that Senators Smith and Wyden were able to include $26 billion over a three-year period in the health plan that they're working on, and it's directed towards coverage of children and the unemployed or the underemployed people. And I would like to have, whoever it is in this building that communicates with the two senators report to us on how they work, because we need to have some input in there. I'm doing it on some education matters, and I tell you, it's tough to really get their attention. And both senators are in the state next week, and so there may be an opportunity to bring one.
Well, why don't we ask the chair if she wants to invite them or one of their staff people to come and explain
how we can have more
integrate
with
the budget that we're dealing with. I think that might be helpful.
Yeah.
Thank you. We'll adjourn the meeting.